I suspect everybody here is familiar with jargon, buzzwords, seemingly familiar phrases that somehow are stripped of any real meaning and can be used to either obfuscate the truth or to confuse people or to seem to have the speaker seem like they know what they're talking about when they are completely clueless. Back when I was working on my MBA a long time ago, my classmates and I were amazed at the amount of jargon that came our way in finance and in marketing and operations management. On and on and on it went. All of this language, all of these simple words that had been repurposed to mean gobbledygook. My favorite example from that time was concentric divergence. Now think about that phrase, concentric divergence. What does it mean? What can it mean? And I see some of you are shaking your heads, and you would have been in good company. Taken out of any context, I can imagine meanings for this phrase, and you could drop a rock into the water, and you could watch the ripples out, and you'll notice that they all are equidistant. But what on earth would this mean in a marketing research class? We never figured it out. So when I went off to divinity school, I thought I'd have a whole new experience. But guess what? In divinity school, we got new buzzwords and new jargon. Phrases like eschatology and soteriology and salvation, and all of this had me scratching my head again. And I thought perhaps maybe I could just marry these two worlds of the MBA and the MDiv, and I could completely snow people by talking about things like the hermeneutics of depreciation. There aren't any. But the truth is that while jargon and buzzwords and similar uses of language are often ways to, again, hide the truth or to hide our own ignorance, at their core, originally, these words and these terms were meant to be helpful to us, and they were meant to be markers for specific things that might happen. So rather than talk about the end of time and the coming of Jesus and God's judgment of humanity, the church began to speak of things like eschatology. But all too often, we use this language and we forget what it's supposed to mean. And we use it often enough that we just think, hey, that's what these words signify, and we don't think through the implications. Today's lesson from John, and indeed to some degree from Revelation, has buzzwords. Lots of them that we can be carried away by and misdirected from knowing their real meaning. And I think a great example in John's gospel is glorification. Now, it's a word he uses more than Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. What does glorification mean? Any suggestions? Do you think perhaps of someone being lifted up and exalted, maybe someone being honored at a parade? And those of us who are old enough remember ticker tape parades in New York and the hero riding in the back of the convertible, waving as the confetti was hurled out of the windows in the Canyon of Heroes. That's glorification, right? Or is that what we think of as glorification? This is a loaded term, and the church has come to develop a theology around glorification, and it has to do with our salvation and how we'll become better people and purged of sin and be ready to meet Jesus and all sorts of complex things that we set aside when we think of that parade. The truth is, glorification is an English word, and the New Testament was not written in English. And despite the theories of some people that God spoke to humanity and gave us his word in the King James Version of the Bible, Jesus was not speaking like Englishman in the early 1600s. Instead, we have this Greek, and the term for glory is doxazo, and that in turn comes from the Hebrew kavod. Now, that's a little misleading because we don't actually know how the Hebrew word would have been spoken. When you look at Hebrew in the Torah, you will see lots of letters running on and on and on. There are no vowels. There's no punctuation. There's no accent marks. So we've made inferences from the text. And in one sense, it does mean glory, to magnify, to make large. But there's another meaning to the word, kavod, in Hebrew. It is used with God's presence. And that is a heaviness, a weightiness. And think back to that rock being dropped in the water. What happens? The water is displaced to make room for the stone. When God's presence was amidst Israel, when it was in the ark and was in the temple, it was here. It wasn't out there. But God works in strange ways. God isn't some kind of bully who tells us what we have to do and makes it happen. We know that God has decided to enter into a partnership with humanity to establish a covenant with us. And that's more jargon. But the covenant is simply an agreement that God will be our God and we will be God's people. We have to make room for God. And all too often, we don't. All too often, we decide to worship false gods. And I don't think anybody here is going home and bowing down before an idol in their living room. But we do worship our jobs and our money and our TV shows and our internet. And we get lost online and we ignore real relationships for people who aren't actually present. And bad things can happen. But imagine if we actually made that space for God's presence to enter into our lives. Really think about that. That would be pretty remarkable. And if each of us did it, it would have an impact on our families and our friends. And if we all did it here, it would have an impact on our community, and things would change. Now, change can be scary. We like things the way they are. And though we may complain, the fact is, some part of us likes inertia. We like to stay where we are. But we're being called out of that inertia to do things differently. And the thing we're called to do is to love one another. Now, there is another word that is often misused and misapplied, but we need to look at love in the context of Jesus. And we need to look at love as Jesus shares it in today's lesson. This is a case where context is king. We need to remember that just before Jesus speaks his words about the new commandment, Judas has betrayed him. Judas has stabbed him in the back. And what is Jesus' response? He doesn't engage in recrimination. He's not bitter. He doesn't want to get back at Judas. Instead, he focuses on the other disciples and he invites them into a life of love. Jesus is modeling behavior for his followers. If we were to allow the glory of God to shape our world, we would live in a world driven by love. Now, this commandment that Jesus shares with us is not really novel. If you go back to Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, you will see that we are called to love one another as we love ourselves. Jesus was immersed in the Hebrew Scriptures. That was his Bible. That's what he knew, and that's what he taught. But Jesus has put his own special twist on the commandments. There is no qualifier. We're just called to love one another, not as we love ourselves, just to love one another, to give of ourselves freely as Jesus, as God, has done himself. So think about that for a moment, this commandment. Do you think it's actually possible to command somebody to love another person? Think back to when you were in grade school. Your teacher probably told you that everybody should be friends and that you should all get along with one another. But if you were like me, there was probably at least one kid in your class that you could not stand. And maybe that kid took your lunch money from you or called you names or was just weird. But still we were told we should all be friends. And if that example doesn't work for you, I invite you to look at your own families. I'm sure there is somebody you don't like in your family, but you love them nonetheless. The love Jesus is talking about is not the kind of love that was displayed at Max Yasgur's farm during Woodstock with people just making out with anybody they saw. This is a different kind of love. This is a kind of love that will change us and will transform us. And it's a love that is worth taking a risk for. You may wonder why we're talking about all of this stuff now. But we're in Eastertide, and we're trying to imagine what the future is like, and we're trying to recall what the disciples were dealing with in the wake of Jesus' resurrection. Last week, I talked about heaven and hell, and I may have surprised some of you by what I said, but I just want to stress that I was not saying that heaven and hell do not exist. I was saying that we cannot know what heaven and hell are like. But as we see from this reading from Revelation, we can imagine the future. We can imagine what things are going to be like. And we look to this text that John of Patmos wrote in exile, and we see him talk about the new heaven and the new earth, replacing the old heaven and the old earth. And we hear about the New Jerusalem coming down from the sky. Now, that's not meant to be a literal description of what is going to happen. It would be pretty neat to see something like that, but that's not what's going on here. John Patmos was trying to describe with limited language God's infinite future. And he goes back to that theme of God coming here to be with us. And the fact that heaven and earth are not two separate spheres, but they're part of one cosmos that God has created. We like to talk about eschatology in the church, the end times. And guess what? They're happening now. Now, I'm not going to tell you to go out and buy the Left Behind books. I'm not suggesting that there's going to be a rapture in which a few of us, and of course I'm including myself here, are going to be taken up to heaven and all of you are all going to be left behind. But I'm describing a future where things are changed, where things are different. And that started happening when Jesus was raised from the dead on Easter long ago. But that process, that eschatology, is not completed. And it's still ongoing. And we have roles to play in bringing about God's future. So let's think about the future we want to come to pass. Jesus has offered us a great roadmap, of a world that is shaped by God's glory and filled with his love. I think that sounds pretty good. I hope you do too.